The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
At the end of the day, you do have, like we talked about last week, the Venezuela function, where people vote not in light of the numbers, but according to a fear factor. And all of a sudden, the money doesn't matter, the debt doesn't matter, the numbers don't matter. It's just a feeling, and it's just panic. That's the danger that you have in market panic in an over-leveraged system.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there's a couple of stories you were telling me last night that I think we should talk about because it involves having enough gas in the tank or enough power. You and your family have been traveling around when you can in an Airstream. So it allows you to travel, do a lot of the business that you do, and still be with your family. But, you know, you're pulling that big old Airstream with a Yukon, which should be enough. The towing requirements say that there's plenty. I heard that you sat by the side of the road for, what, 2 hours waiting for the thing to cool down here just a few days ago. Do you have enough gas in the tank or enough power in the engine, I guess I should say?
You know, the specs say that we're just fine, but I'm curious if really the engineering is inadequate and that what we need is a truck. So at least on paper, the Yukon's supposed to be able to pull this thing.
Right.
But yeah, we sort of turned lemons to lemonade as we had a little chocolate tasting and watched a movie and just tried to figure out what we're going to do with 2 hours on the side of the road.
The family thought this was planned, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Probably.
Well, okay, so on Sunday, you are, again, preparing for another half Ironman, and that's 3 weeks out. So you're having to put the hard, long rides in. You had a 70-some-odd mile ride on Sunday, but you told me, same type of thing. You rode hard, but you really didn't feel like you fueled correctly because you didn't have the power that you wanted.
Yeah, I know the distances, and I know what it takes to get that done in terms of the training rides. And this was not a distance very much further than the race distance. But yeah, not enough fuel in the tank. Not enough fuel in the tank. And this is my third for the season, final. I think Mary Catherine's going to be glad that this season's done. And
yeah,
she has a little bit more visibility on Dave on the weekends.
Sure, sure. You know, I'm going to tie this in because, you know, there's these amazing headlines that have been coming out saying homeowners are sitting on a record amount of cash. That's that liquidity that it takes to fuel the economy, to pull the trailer, to drive the bike. But it's a little deceptive, isn't it, when they say $5.8 trillion is just sitting there waiting to be spent.
The CNBC headline was a little disingenuous. Homeowners sitting on a record amount of cash. To be precise, it didn't mention that that is home equity. And it's not exactly the same thing as cash. I mean, on that basis, if you're looking at the flow of funds report from the Federal Reserve, corporate America has an extra $10 trillion in liquidity just sitting around.
So if you're willing to mortgage the farm itself is sitting there as cash, is what you're saying.
Exactly. If you could get all of that liquid, that's not fake news. It's just not good journalism.
Right. Dave, before we jump in on some of the economic numbers, I'd like to, you know, address the gold market, because what happens every year about this time, people start to go to sleep. There is this hypnosis. The little bit of news that we're watching, you know, Supreme Court judge appointments and that type of thing, I think we get distracted from when it is a good time to buy. And we do have certain clients right now who are going, gosh, nobody is buying gold. This must be a good time to buy. And those of you who are listening, and we've talked about this week, it's hard to do that emotionally when the emotion isn't to buy. But the sentiment index, in other words, where people are at right now, is below 10. That's always been a bottoming period.
Right. Feelings for us are a big indicator of where you're at in the marketplace. So on the one extreme, when it seems like you cannot lose and things are only going up and you begin to extrapolate and you've got your, maybe even you keep a pro forma spreadsheet of what your investments would be worth at X and Y and Z.
Mm.
If you do, just understand that you're subject to making mistakes in terms of what we would call the error of optimism. Well, the sentiment that drives markets is equally powerful on the other end of the extreme, which would be the error of pessimism. And, you know, the daily sentiment index, which you mentioned for gold, sits right around 8%. And as a contrary indicator, gold's ready to rally.
Right.
You've got the Elliott Wave folks who've drawn some very nice charts that show over a 30, 40 year period, every time gold gets below 10%, that is, again, dealing with the sentiment indicator and the number of people who are actually interested in buying, that's a turn in the market. It represents a bottom. You run out of sellers. And, you know, hedge funds here recently have taken their positions to the lowest levels since late 2015. Now, December 2015 is when the market turned at 1,050, and hedge funds have now taken their exposures down to about that level. That was just prior to a 30% move in gold. That's a 30% move higher.
Right, right.
And if you're looking at the mining shares, 160 to 200% move there in 2016, a very strong year. So, you know, speaking of seasonality, the guys on Golden Rule Radio in-house covered seasonality, I think, very well last week. Feel free to dip into the archives and see what they're saying on that. That's our program that deals specifically with the metals on a week-in, week-out basis. But July is quite often the seasonal low.
Right.
So if you don't like overpaying, as you were suggesting earlier, then think about allocating. And I would do that soon.
And you were talking about not necessarily fake news, but bad news. You know, I keep thinking about what this U3 is, this thing that we call the unemployment. We're not really counting 95 to 100 million people who aren't looking for work anymore, but we're told that unemployment right now is at a 50-year low. Well, if you don't understand the other parts of those numbers, how can you not be excited that the economy is booming?
Yeah. So this last week we had the U3, which bumped up actually from 3.75, 3.8, that range up to 4%. And you think, well, gosh, then the unemployment number is getting worse. U6 edged up as well. But here's what happened. You've got 601,000 people that started looking for work in June. And I think it's worth recalling that the number, the employment number, has improved considerably as people have quit looking for work. Mm-hmm. I know that may not even make sense, but that's the way they count the numbers.
Don't they drop off the list after a year?
Yeah. And so the opposite of that is it gets worse. The employment number gets worse when people resume looking for work. So, yes, they were still unemployed, but now that they're looking again, they're counted again. So, that not in the labor force number, which we've harped on for years, includes 95.5 million people. They're categorized as not working.
That's a third of America.
But they're not considered unemployed either. Until they get back to looking, right? Or if they get a part-time job or whatever, they can be in that category of quote-unquote underemployed and be subsumed into the U6 number. So are you confused yet? I think, honestly, that is as intended. And I just can't help but think that the current labor shortage, that's what a lot of the news outlets are talking about right now, is there's a labor shortage that is directly tied to the 95 million people that are not in the labor force.
Right,
and,
right.
And granted, this is a complex issue. You've got education involved. You've got skills and retraining, which may be necessary. But if we have a mismatch, if we truly have a mismatch between job openings, and there's tons of job openings, and we've got available labor, or unavailable labor, I guess, then wages should be pressing significantly higher. That would be a net result if you're looking at the supply of labor, the demand for labor. If wages do not increase significantly, and I hope everyone remembers this, if wages do not increase significantly, then we need to dig deeper into the BLS in numbers, which I think could arguably be considered duplicitous.
Okay, so that's unemployment, but I want to jump back into politics because we are in an election year, okay? And you and I, last week, we talked about playing a thought experiment. If we're Democrat, what do we do to shift the tide? Because right now, there is a very strong support for Trump. And, you know, we talked about pulling the rug out on the economy, which is a possibility. The Federal Reserve could still raise rates quickly, maybe not. But, you know, talking to people, you don't have Democrats and you don't have Republicans anymore. Most of the people who were voting, who voted for Trump, they just didn't want to vote for a politician. And a lot of them, I've talked to the younger generation, and a lot of them would have voted for Bernie Sanders just as easily as they voted for Trump. They just didn't want a politician. So what if, let's play this thought experiment now. Let's say that they don't pull the rug out on the economy, but instead they just say, okay, no, we're not going to run true Democrats anymore. What we're going to do is we're going to run socialists or even communists, because honestly, socialism in many cases is just a euphemism for communism. So doesn't it look like the Democratic Party is starting to turn socialist at this point?
Well, and obviously Bernie Sanders is a politician. He just casts himself as someone who is so non-establishment. He's the non-establishment Democrat, just like you have a non-establishment Republican. And I think you're right. Had they been given the choice of non-establishment anything, they would have gravitated perhaps more towards Bernie than perhaps some of them did towards Trump.
It seems that that's happening right now in some of these races.
Right. And, you know, Bret Stephens, writing for the New York Times, was concerned on a similar point that the Democratic Party is being taken over by socialists. This is his words, his concerns. Democratic socialism, in his opinion, is running up against constraints. Some of those constraints are just as simple as math constraints. Mm. You can't have, again, in his words, unlimited governmental largesse and unlimited immigration. Actually, when he was writing that, it reminded me of the old money problem that Margaret Thatcher used to talk about.
Right.
You know, and again, I'm shocked, frankly, reading the New York Times, because it's very rare to see sort of anything critical of the Democratic Party or Democratic Party politics. But, you know, Thatcher used to say the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money.
Right. Other people's money.
Yeah. And Stevens is basically saying, hey, wait a minute. You can't have it open-ended policies where you're going to spend on everybody and then create an infinite audience for that spending. The math doesn't work. And again, you know what I really enjoy about the New York Times? Not always sort of the assumptions that go into the articles, but sometimes you get just facts, which is nice sometimes, and you also get great obituaries. They write the greatest obituaries of any paper on the planet. So in case you're wondering why the New York Times, particularly the Sunday.
What's Dave turned to? What is it that he's reading there?
Well, it's the obituaries, first and foremost. Malcolm McLennan. Malcolm McLennan was a guy that I used to work with at Morgan Stanley, and he was very keen. He would read the obituaries in every paper every day. And at the time, you know, in my early 20s, I thought, that is a strange habit.
Yeah.
And then I started looking at him, and I thought, these are really interesting people who've lived really interesting lives. Now, honestly, if you're talking about a small town paper, that may not be the case, but the New York Times features...
There's a difference. When you live in a small town, you're reading the obituaries for a completely different reason. I know we're chasing a rabbit here, but before I canceled my Economist magazine, I found out that really the first thing that I was doing was reading the back page, the obituaries. So I hear what you're saying. There are a lot of interesting people. It's too bad we really find out how interesting after they die.
All right. Now, I'm sorry. I derailed the conversation on the obituaries, but...
Okay. Back to socialism, our favorite subject.
I just wonder if maybe Bret Stephens isn't watching the trends. And, you know, you've got the DNC chair saying that New York primary race winner, you may recall this is from a couple weeks ago, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents, quote unquote, the future of our party. And this is a gal who has basically said, you know, yes, the specific words, I'm a democratic socialist, not, you know, in the Democratic Party per se, but she wants to break the definitions and the identity and move more towards something that I've seen quotes from her that actually reference communism as a preferred political philosophy. Mm. And the fascinating thing about the upset in that primary was that the incumbent Democrat, Joseph Crowley, he was fourth ranked in the House. This is a guy who's been in politics for a couple of decades, right? And there was talk that he might replace Nancy Pelosi as the House Speaker. Now, he's out on his ear because somebody steps in and starts promising everything for free and basically the creation of lynch mobs for the rich. And it's fascinating that that did have appeal, right? And we know that 2016 was volatile and an expression of populist angst. But we said at the time, it doesn't matter that it's conservative in its expression here, because you've got the five-star movement and other places around the world that are expressing the same kind of frustration, but it's on the other end of the political spectrum.
Yeah, you better be careful what you're voting for when you're voting populist, because you can certainly get something that you don't want.
Kevin, we've been doing the commentary for over 10 years now, every week. And so it was years ago that you were in New York visiting your daughter and went by the park where the Occupy Wall Street folks
were. No, I spent hours talking to the Occupy people.
And the fascinating thing is there is a connection point here between both conservatives and liberals as it references the critique of the establishment. And it's the funding mechanism for the establishment as we know it. And central to that is our central bank. Central to that is the Federal Reserve, willing to create infinite amounts of credit, infinite amounts of money, and it fuels the problems that the Occupy Wall Street folks saw, and it also fuels just about every other iteration if you're talking about fiscal or monetary largesse, right? So there is a common ground, and you may say, well, the spectrum left and right are so far, how can they have anything in common? On this point, they're right next to each other.
And a good example of that, I just thought of this when you said that. There was a man that I talked to at Occupy Wall Street. They were very upset. They had no idea what they were upset about, but they were very upset. And he had two documents in his pocket. He pulled out the U.S. Constitution, and he then pulled out the Communist Manifesto. He had both. And as far as he was concerned, there was no problem there. And so this is why we have to understand, what is the foundation of what we're asking for when we vote?
All right. So the Washington Times. This was fantastic. They're reporting on a community newspaper, Beaumont, Texas. If you don't know Beaumont, you don't need to know Beaumont, honestly. And I say that because I've got family who was born and raised in La Porte, not far from Beaumont. This is like south of Houston. It's the only part of the Houston area that has never grown and developed, and it never will. I'm just telling you, there's a reason why no one goes there, and there's been nothing changed since the 1950s and 60s. But the newspaper there in Beaumont starts posting excerpts. This is all featured in the Washington Times this last week, by the way. So July 4th, Washington Times is talking about this. Newspaper in South Texas posts excerpts of the Declaration of Independence on its Facebook page. It's an educational process. By the way, we read it out loud last week as a family. And, you know, given our family's sort of penchant towards drama, a couple of my kids are in musical theater and Mary Catherine's too, they enjoy a very robust reading. It's, it needs to be delivered as if it was by the founders. But anyways, the Times reported, they put up 9 of these excerpts, they put up the 10th and it doesn't post. And Facebook gives them an automated response explaining that the post, quote unquote, goes against our standards on hate speech.
So the algorithm for hate speech basically cut out words from the Declaration of Independence,
according to Facebook, is in the category of hate speech, at least this particular section of it. And, you know, I mean, listen, as a family guy, I hold curating to be part and parcel of intentionality and of a life well lived. But here's an example of curatorial work. I mean, Facebook's thought police, they should not, in my opinion, be the arbiters of what we know from history, of how we reflect on the modern era. And I don't know that the Facebook editorial committee, maybe it's not the editorial committee, maybe it is fair to say it's an algorithm, but that they should be doing the curatorial work for what we as a society see as hate speech or appropriate language or whatnot. This is one of our founding documents.
Dave, I think it was an algorithm. Okay, these algorithms have been written for political correctness. They've been written to identify anything that would possibly upset the system as it's been deemed appropriate. You know, what's happening to society right now? This social networking is really changing the way we think.
Debate is a skill set. You don't get to be a good debater without practice. And that's no longer a part of an educational process. Kids don't go to school and figure out how to take both sides of an argument. They are taught one side and taught to defend one side as if that is the only thing that exists, the only data point, the only perspective that is legitimate. And there is a basic lack of respect for humanity when you teach kids to not engage in conversation and debate. And I think that's what we're ending up with. If you want to see a trend towards hate speech, it is that people have an inability to communicate between themselves and to dialogue over issues, even over issues that they disagree on.
You know, you have been bothered and wondered what itch is scratched with social networking. When you dig deeper, I mean, we're all human. We're driven by very much the same drives. They just change on the surface as to how they manifest. What is it, Dave, that social networking scratches that people are so into it at this point?
I think it deals with identity. I think it deals with who we are, who we're becoming, how we perceive ourselves. And I'm engrossed in a book right now by a psychotherapist from the UK, regular commentator on BBC Radio. And this book looks at the impact of social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter on individual development. So I guess I'll share a little bit more than that as I get closer to finishing it. But there's growing evidence, and this is other research, not necessarily in this book, that social networking sites over time begin to rewire brain function. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously there's some concern about kids and, you know, sort of the formative years. But I mean, this author starts with a quote that I think is a great way of framing our engagement with technology from Melvin Kranzberg, who's a historian from the University of Georgia. Maybe it was Georgia Tech. I forget where he's from exactly. But he says technology, this is Melvin Kranzberg, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. Hmm. So, when I reflect on Facebook's curatorial work on the Declaration of Independence, they put a brand new twist on the quote unquote, nor is it neutral part, right? So as we look at 2016, as we look at 2017, obviously we've got peaks in terms of the valuations for Amazon and for Facebook and for Google and for Tesla. And I wonder if to some degree we might not be putting in a peak in terms of the value and influence of social networking. You look at the critique that you've had from some of the Facebook executives who have left the company, right? Sort of a mea culpa for disturbing the fabric of society.
Right. The apology commercials, is that what you're addressing at this point?
Well, no, that's different. I mean, those commercials are, we told you one thing about what we were doing with your data. Oops, we lied. I mean, it's like Wells Fargo.
But now trust us. Now trust us.
But there's a whole new Facebook. Right. And there's a whole new Wells Fargo, right? So they are on a PR campaign. Now, I'm thinking of the guy, he gave a speech at Stanford and said, basically, we've created tools that have ripped apart the social fabric of how society works. Hmm. And what he was critical of is this sort of constant dopamine-driven feedback where people are concerned about how they're perceived, what their standing is, how many quote unquote friends they have. And this goes back to, again, the idea of what I would consider the perfect environment for hate speech. This is not a place where there is conversation. And this was his point in his presentation to the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He said there's no civil discourse. There's no cooperation. It's to some degree misinformation, mistruth, and it's not an American problem. This is not about Russian ads. He said this is a global problem. So the book I'm reading is not actually a critique of social networking sites, but it does ask, I think, some very important questions about the consequences of engagement. And those can be good consequences or bad consequences. But you're right. It's fascinating right now to watch in the mainstream media, Facebook and Wells Fargo do this sort of ethics makeover dance on prime time.
Something I think we have to keep in mind, Dave, you're in your 40s, I'm in my 50s. So a lot of the people who are running the government right now in their 60s and their 70s, the true leaders that are coming into, you know, we sometimes talk about this fourth turning that we talked to Neil Howe about. If we're in a fourth turning, that means there's a first turning, new start coming in the next decade or two. And if that's the case, it's not really our generation, okay? And it's not the generation right now that's in power that needs to be engaged with the proper things. It's the people in their teens, 20s, and 30s right now. We have to look at them as the future leaders. And if they're the ones right now who are being changed by social networking, we have to look at what the ramifications of that would be.
Well, and again, I don't know if that's a reason for optimism or pessimism, because as is the case with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's 28 years old.
Right.
So, I mean, radical socialist who's, according to the DNC, redefining what, she's the future of the party. I mean, yes, past tense, we've got a reflection of people who contributed at a very young age. James Monroe, 18 in 1776. Aaron Burr was 20. Alexander Hamilton, of course, of greater popular fame today because of Broadway. He was 21 years old.
21. Wow.
July 4th, 1776, he was 21. James Madison was 25. Thomas Jefferson was 33. So, I mean, is this a reason for optimism or a reason for pessimism? A first turning event is an opportunity, but to me, it's like watching the ball, the football. It's been kicked. It's in the air. And we really don't know which way it's going to bounce. This could help us greatly, or it could hurt us badly. And it kind of depends on which direction the ball bounces.
Well, you look at the ages of those guys. That's just amazing. I've never thought of that. But I always think of them as old guys in powdered wigs.
But the old guys wearing powdered wigs were John Adams at age 40 in 1776 and George Washington at age 44. Those are the old guys.
Yeah. And these are the heroes that wrote the Independence that we live today, you know, that Facebook just filtered out as hate speech.
Amazing. Amazing. So, I mean, arguably, our education standards are not what they used to be, not precisely what they used to be. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that change typically comes from youth. And we're getting close to that. You're right. Neil Howe's book, The Fourth Turning, if you're a listener and you've not read that book, I think it's a very interesting historical overlay to give you some perspective on the social and cultural changes that happen on a periodic
looking
basis,
at 600 years.
600 years of British and American history. And, you know, what you see, at least coming into a period of crisis and on the other side of that renewal, is you can have something that looks very different. So look at sort of the summer of 1968. Mm-hmm. Summer of 68 was violent if you were in Paris. We had Bobby Kennedy assassinated. We had all kinds of crazy things happening in the United States, and it was youth-driven, largely. The winter of 1776, you've got these guys who aren't sure they can hold on by their fingernails, but I think it was youthful tenacity and grit that got them through what was otherwise, they were losing the battle. They were losing the battle. December 25th, 1776, all hope was lost. And yet youth, I think, held on for something greater. It really remains to be seen which way the ball bounces.
You know, I look back at the last 60 years, okay, as we go through that first turning after World War II and the second turning, you know, you were talking about the 60s and the 70s, the third turning, and now we're in the fourth turning, you know, using Neil Howe's model. But here's the difference. Okay. We went through our first turning as the largest creditor nation in the world. We had money. Okay. We were on a gold standard when we were coming into the first turning back in the 1950s. At this point, we're in a fourth turning and we have run on credit now for at least 40 years. We've run on unpayable credit. Is it the credit crunch that will ultimately lead when this system fails, this system of just borrowing more than you know you can pay back and living like you can? Okay. When that fails, which we know it will that be the entrance into this next turning?
When you look at sort of the calculus of excess and the normal time frames that we have looking back in time, you know, where you would expect to see things begin to deteriorate or unwind, I wonder if time frames aren't in fact stretched because of the interventionism and the tools that are being used by central banks. But, you know, Bloomberg points out Stephen Major. He is with HSBC, a renowned bond analyst with them. And he says that we already have a credit crunch. It's taking hold, but it's in slow motion. And it's being ignored because it's happening at a snail's pace. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's looking at all of these sort of signs and symptoms and saying, it's real. He says the stock market sell-offs, the volatility blow-ups, the collapsing cryptocurrencies, they're all symptoms of an unfolding global credit squeeze. And yeah, I do think that does tie to the fourth turning. I don't think it's an accident that we're here at the end of 30, 40 years of credit excess, experimenting with new tools in order to extend time that has never been on the clock, right? So if you look at past periods of credit crisis, we haven't had the extra time because we didn't have the tools. It doesn't change the fact that we have massive credit excess and we are at the edges of an unwind.
And that's the point. When you can borrow money, you can mask the volatility. You can mask the signals. Now, you know, Gundlach has been speaking about this and saying, you know, watch out, guys. If you're out there risking money right now, you might have your timing wrong.
Well, and a part of it is looking at two things, high stock valuations and high bond valuations. Mm. And, you know, he's been keen. He does communicate via Twitter, and yes, we do keep in touch. While we're interested in a critique of the social networking sites, we also use them yeah. and are not Luddites sticking our head in the sand and saying technology will drive us over a cliff.
It's not good or bad, and it's not neutral.
And it's not neutral.
Right.
Right. So the yield curve, he says, is nearly flat between the 2-year and the 10-year. You've got the Fed, which is tightening. We've got tariffs. We've got high stock and bond valuations and exploding deficit. That equals risk, not Goldilocks. And that was his recent Twitter send. Hmm. But let's look at the yield curve, because from the 2-year to the 30, nearly flat is an understatement. You've got 3-month treasury bills at 1.9%. Just keep these numbers in mind. 1.9. Your 2 years at 2.5. Your 5 years at 2.7. Your 10 years at 2.8. You're 30 years at 2.9. Now, you know, maybe it's 272 and 282 and 232, but I mean, we're talking 10 basis points difference for decades worth of duration risk, credit risk, inflation risk, right?
That's the masking. That's the masking right there.
Yeah. The only thing more disconcerting is the idea of interest rate normalization in a place like Europe, right? Because Draghi, he's discussed the slowing of the pace of purchases there. He's talked about ending the purchases there as he gets towards December and handing the baton off to somebody else to manage the European Central Bank. But, you know, these are rates that we just mentioned for the United States. As a reminder, I mean, rates are not telling you anything about credit, credit quality, inflation risk. And you really get this point when you look at the Greek 10-year at 3.93, under 4%.
Right. This is a country that's almost guaranteed to fail on the payment of those bonds.
The Portuguese are financing their 10-year debt at 1.8 and we're at 2.8, right? What does that tell you? The Italians are financing their 10-year paper at 2.7 and our 10-year is at 2.8. What is it telling you? What it's telling you is that you've got a central bank footprint in the market, which has completely distorted the signaling from the numbers, right? I mean, and we could talk about the Germans at 29 basis points or the French at 64 basis points or the UK, which still has to go through its whole Brexit process. And they're financing their paper at 50% less than we are. 10-year, their gilts that are at 1.27%. What it says to me, Kevin, is that 2019 to 2020 is going to be very painful if you're a fixed income investor and you get exposure to Europe. Yeah, of course, the QE could be redoubled and you could see the ECB go back in and start buying tens of billions of dollars every month. We could see that. But I think the point here is that interest rates are ridiculously low. Mm-hmm. Bond prices are ridiculously high, getting back to Jeff Gundlach's Twitter feed. And we're at this point where the Trader's Almanac, if you're looking at the Stock Trader's Almanac, it's saying you're moving into the wrong season of the year. Markets subject to elevated volatility after July 4th, reads the Stock Trader's Almanac. July begins NASDAQ's worst 4 months, end quote. That's from the Stock Trader's Almanac.
Okay, but let me ask you, when we're talking about the stock market, a lot of times we think, oh, this is the broad market. This is everything. It's either rising or falling. I mean, you really have just a few stocks that are driving the whole market right now.
Well, you could say five stocks, most of them technology shares, are driving the S&P and the NASDAQ bonkers. And there is a divergence between those indexes and the Dow. The Dow is actually lower for the year, while the S&P and the NASDAQ have maintained positive territory. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that you, just as we talked earlier about there being a seasonal low for gold, guess what? It's not without coincidence that you put in a seasonal high and stocks begin to trade off after the July 4th weekend or week.
Till about October, right? October,
through
November.
October. Yeah. Typically, you can see a little bit of a revival in stocks as you move towards the end of the year. But up through October, you've got a couple of nasty months. So, you know, again, the Dow is 2,500 points off of its January all-time high peak. You get the Wall Street Journal saying that merger and acquisition activity is on pace to beat 2007 this year. I mean, again, what are the signs and symptoms of where we're at in the cycle? Does M&A activity mean anything to you? Well, in 2007, we did $4.3 trillion worth of mergers and acquisitions. And if we keep on track at the current pace, we'll have 4.8 this year. Now, does 2007 mean anything to you? I mean, we were also putting in peaks in the stock market. Right. 2007, again, real estate was booming and all was well. 2007 was like this picture perfect year, right? Except that when anything's picture perfect, usually you're not looking close enough.
And you know, if you think back, Dave, it was January of 2008 that we started this show. 2007, you're right. We were putting in perfect peaks and people really didn't want to know what was happening because it was going to happen for forever. By 2008, we had to have a medium where we could talk to a lot of people every week because everyone wanted to know what the heck just happened. Okay.
Right. And what the heck just happened was really interesting in 2008.
Okay. So liquidity. I want to go back to how we started the show because your legs ran out of liquidity on Sunday.
Yes,
okay.
They did. And I had a friend tell me, he said, why did you go on a 70 plus mile ride with two water bottles? And I said, well, that's a good question. I didn't have, that's a good question.
But when you run out of steam and you're on a long ride and there's the expectation that you're going to do just as well without the liquidity, you've got a surprise coming. And one of the ways that we see this liquidity, I mean, other than the weird news story about how much money people have in equity in their homes, and that's just cash waiting to be spent. But credit spreads. Credit spreads usually tell us how much liquidity that we have to expect as we move forward.
You know, we've had some folks from the Bank of International Settlements check in with us. William White was a guest on the program not long ago. He also moonlights with the OECD in Paris. And the folks who put together the BIS annual report said this very interestingly on illiquidity in the markets and credit spreads. Credit spreads have been unusually compressed, often or even below pre-global financial crisis levels, and the corresponding markets appear to have become increasingly illiquid.
Mm-hmm.
And that comment from the BIS, that's their annual report just out here in the last week or so, I think is worth keeping in mind because we think that there is plenty of liquidity in the system, and they're seeing that actually there's not a lot of liquidity there. It's a worthy quote to keep in mind because should a significant market decline emerge as we head into the fall, the liquidity backdrop is not as robust as pricing would indicate if you're looking at the stock market or the bond market. And I know we mentioned this in passing last week, but I think it bears repeating. Part one of the liquidity mirage in the stock market is that corporate buybacks and corporate buying of shares is very, very robust.
Right. That's not the public coming in and buying. It's the companies buying back shares actually at highs.
So there's less real liquidity in the market if you take out corporate buybacks. But part two of the liquidity mirage in the stock market is that margin buying is back towards those highs. We mentioned it last week, $669 billion, according to FINRA. And it's just one of many signals.
Right.
It's one of many signals that you need to hold onto your hat.
We've talked about the tech stocks, but some of these stocks are actually not catching back up. I mean, I'm thinking about the financials, the industrials. Unless they start doing what some of these small count of tech stocks are doing, we don't really have a rally.
Right. If your financials and industrials either get on board, I mean, that's one scenario, is that they start playing catch up to the tech sector, or else, frankly, there's not much room on the upside. Again, as the Almanac suggests, and of course, that's just speaking in generalities. It doesn't say absolutely every year at this time, but in general, on July 4th, you begin to see NASDAQ sell off.
Even within the techs, though, you have to look at what kind of technology you're talking about, because not all technology is rallying.
Fred Hickey's spot on in this point. The semiconductors have been the weakest within the tech sector. And as he pounds the table constantly, you might recall he was one of the contributors in the Barron's Roundtable, and he's always got good things to say on tech, or insightful things to say on tech. Semiconductors are a very good leading indicator, and they're already off by 15 to 30%. Right. So they've already sold off. Financials have sold off. Industrials have sold off. They're not participating in the S&P 500 and NASDAQ rallies. And the curious investor will want to ask why. Will want to ask why. The SOX, which is the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, just pull a chart on that. And again, as a leading indicator, it's suggesting we're at the end of a tech cycle.
Is it a lot like copper is with commodities, you know, and the economy? A lot of times they call copper Dr. Copper. Could we call this Dr. Semiconductor?
You know, if copper's not participating as the economy is ramping up, then something's not right.
Mm.
And so Dr. Copper, the prices of lumber, the sell-off, which have already occurred if you're looking at home builder stocks, robust economic activity is typically accompanied by all of those elements rising rapidly at the same time,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think it's very important to look at Toll Brothers. It's very important to look at some of the other home builders and say, you know, why aren't they moving higher? If housing starts are what the news says they are, and if copper prices began selling off in January, and they're now in a renewed, spirited decline here over the last 30 days. Lumber, if you're looking at sort of the last year or two, it doubled off its lows in 2017 and has given back only about 10% now. But it has given back 10%. And so I think you want to look at some of these things coupled with the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index and just ask yourself the question, which is likely to mean revert? The NASDAQ to a lower level, or the financials and the industrials, are they going to confirm a move higher in equities to the upside?
The last 40 or 50 years have pretty much been run on credit. I would imagine as these guys are sitting down looking at their expenses running these companies, they'd have to say, well, what happens if interest rates do continue to rise like Powell has promised?
Well, right, because rates are a very relevant factor in terms of economic growth. And particularly when the kind of economic growth that we've had is so dependent on an expansion of debt, right? When rates begin to rise and you've been dependent on an expanded base of debt, now the interest component becomes very, very critical. Watch the interest expense rise for corporations. Watch the interest expense for governments. Watch the interest expense for individuals. This is a domestic issue. It's an international issue. I think this is going to be a major factor over the next 18 months as shorter-term liabilities and debt instruments have to be rolled over.
And it translates to you and I. The corporations are going to have higher expenses, but that gets passed down to you and I.
Yeah, I mean, just to illustrate, and again, this is not just a U.S. issue, but it is for the common man anywhere in the world. Jim Grant points to the impact on individuals in his recent missive, highlighting the high number of interest-only loans in Australia. High number of interest-only loans in Australia. Debt as a percentage of disposable income in that country has been steadily rising. It's now 188% debt compared to disposable income. Households have taken advantage of interest-only loans, in large part because the cost of housing has skyrocketed in recent years. And now as rates rise, many of those homeowners on the front edge of interest-only expiry.
Right.
And so you've got the assistant governor for the Reserve Bank of Australia, Christopher Kent, who's looking down the pike and saying, not good. This is not good. In a speech in Sydney here in just the last week or so, he says, you've got $120 billion in interest-only loans.
And I should say that's no equity loans. This is interest-only. You're paying only interest at that point.
Yeah, you're not paying any principal. You're not paying down the debt. You're just keeping the interest meter going.
It's like renting from the bank.
Well, that's right. But you've got $120 billion in interest-only loans, which will convert to principal and interest loans each year. $120 billion each year for the next 3 years. That will require a payment increase of between 30 and 40%.
Wow.
Now, you tell me how that would impact your budget if your rent check to the bank increased by 30 to 40%. And what's fascinating to me, I don't even understand this, but the conjecture on Christopher Kent's part is that the majority of people who have interest-only loans don't realize that they're only interest and have no idea that their mortgage payment is getting ready to go up by 30 to 40%. So you're dealing with a country just like the United States where real incomes have been stagnant for 20 years.
Right. So they don't have new money coming in that's going to cover this 30 to 40% jump.
Right. Governments really in the same position. Globally, you know, as we track the increase in U.S. interest rates, debt burdens are moving higher as a percentage of tax receipts, not only here, but in other places too. The U.S., I think we have time on our side, but not a whole lot of time. You know, Fed funds rate is between 1.75 and 2%. To really consider that normalized, you've got to be back in the 4 to 5% range. Mm-hmm. And that's, it seems far off.
John Taylor would tell you that.
Right. Yep. But these levels seem pretty high, 4 to 5% relative to the last 5 years of near zero rates, but they're actually in the range here, 1.7 to 2%. They're in a range that was considered low in every other period of history in the United States as we were heading into recession or needed to lower rates in order to accommodate economic slowdown. We would bring rates down to the current levels, 1.75 or 2%. So you factor that in. A rate increase, doubling from here to 4% or 5%, what's the impact for a fixed income investor? A minor interest rate increase, 1, 2% is going to take 15, maybe even 20% of a bite out of a fixed income portfolio, a treasury portfolio.
Dave, we talk about how it'll impact the individual, but what happens is when corporations can't pay their interest, they cut salaries, they cut people. Talk about the unemployment rate. I mean, look at what happens down in South America.
Governments are the same. Corporations are the same. I read a report from Costa Rica discussing the need for cuts currently in public salaries and expenses. I've got some friends that spend a lot of time in Nicaragua. They're going through a similar cycle where rates are on the increase. Budgets are not matching up.
Interest rate rises are squeezing the stuff that puts food on the table.
Governments are moving towards austerity and laying people off. In the case of Nicaragua, you've had riots and a couple hundred people killed. In the case of Costa Rica, there's no violence except in the upward move of interest expenses. There, in the last year, you've had an interest expense, governmental interest expense, jump by 48%.
Mm.
That's in 1 year. There will be a lot of hype coming back around to corporate America. There's going to be a lot of hype over the current quarterly earnings numbers. But I wonder at what point the interest expense for corporations ends up putting a massive dent in corporate earnings. This is my recommendation to you. If you've got selective hand-picked publicly traded companies in your portfolio, you want to look at the maturity schedules for those companies, and you want to make sure that you don't have rollover risk, which is embedded in your equity positions. Just let that sink in. You don't think about your stock portfolio having rollover risk. That's usually for a bond portfolio. But you've got highly leveraged U.S. corporations and multinational corporations, and you want to be aware of what their payment plan is like. Let me give you two examples. IBM. IBM has tens of billions of dollars in debt, tens of billions, right? But that pales in comparison with AT&T. AT&T is coming up on $250 billion of debt. $250 billion in debt. Now, what's the payment for it? Do they have to come up with $50 billion next year and either roll it over or pay it off?
Think about that. If it goes up 1%, okay, $250 billion. If it goes up 1%, that's $2.5 billion more they're paying just on interest. And we know a lot of these corporations are taking that debt and buying shares at a stock market high.
AT&T is now the 32nd most leveraged entity on the planet. And that is a corporation
larger than many countries.
Oh yeah, they're right. I don't know if they're right before or right after Indonesia, but I mean, they're 32nd on the list of indebted entities, right? So how much rollover risk do you have in that particular equity position? People don't think about rollover risk in equities, but you should in a world that is over leveraged.
We need to think about that with our good old debt here in the United States. The United States government is not immune from rollover risk.
Right. So $21.2 trillion is the number that we may have to contend with. Pare that back a little bit because 25% of it is sort of intergovernmental loans. So you could argue that 25% doesn't even matter. It's the government paying the government, and it's interest from one entity paid to another arm of the government.
Of course, ask Venezuela. You can just print your way out of anything. So really, if you're borrowing from yourself and paying yourself back with your printed money, Venezuela has shown us that that can be done for a while.
But it's still relevant to look at the 75%, right? The 75%, which is owned by the public, whether it's the public in the United States or abroad. You've got average maturities on U.S. debt, 5 years, right? So it's, we've financed all of our debt, tens of trillions of dollars, more or less short term. So 20% of the total is going to have to be refinanced each year for the next 5 years.
And this is to the buying public. This is not to the government itself.
That's correct. Try to keep that number conservative. My guess is that what happens over the next 5 years is that we take our interest payments on the national debt from, let's say, 280, 300 billion a year to 600 or even 750 billion. We might even see $1 trillion a year in interest payments, which would put us somewhere between 15 and 25% of all government revenues going just to pay for the interest component, right? Does that put a drag on growth? You know, we're talking about 2018, this year, having a budget deficit of $830 billion. This year. It's really not hard to imagine blowout deficits as we move into 2019, 2020, 2021. Again, just looking at interest rates, right? So the area of contest remains the central bank arena. The question remains, how much latitude do they have to control sentiment? Because at the end of the day, you do have, like we talked about last week, the Venezuela function. And what is that exactly? It's where people vote not in light of the numbers, but according to a fear factor. And all of a sudden, the money doesn't matter, the debt doesn't matter, the numbers don't matter. It's just a feeling and it's just panic. Right. And again, we're probably last in line globally, but we're still in line, and we may change place and cut line if we're not careful. That's the danger that you have in market panic in an over leveraged system.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.